Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream. I'm your host, Brooking Gatewood.
And I'm your co-host, Matt Prindeville.
Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution.
Hey, what's up, Solutioneers? Welcome back to the Indisposable Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Prindeville, CEO and Chief Solutioneer at Upstream. And today is a special episode because I'm really excited to have my friends and colleagues, Kirsty Petchy from the Conservation Law Foundation and Judith Enck from Beyond Plastics on the show. Kirsty, Judith, really excited to connect with you both. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Thrilled to be with you.
Always good to see both of you. Thanks, Matt.
So today we're going to dive deeper into extended producer responsibility for packaging, or EPR. And I know we've got a sophisticated audience, but for those of you that are just hearing about it for the first time, EPR is a policy tool that makes consumer brands legally and financially responsible for mitigating the environmental impacts of their products and packaging. And in general, you know, the three of us agree that we need to have corporations have some skin in the game when it comes to green design and taking their packaging back for reuse or recycling. But the devil's in the details. You know, there's good EPR and there's bad EPR. And at the end of the day, Upstream's position has been and continues to be that EPR really shouldn't just exist for itself. It really fundamentally needs to be about creating a circular economy for packaging that prioritizes the waste reduction hierarchy and reduce and reuse above recycling. And Kirsty and Judith have been working intimately on EPR in several states this legislative session, as well as deposit return systems for beverages, commonly known as bottle bills, which we think of as the original EPR. So we're going to get into all that, but I want to start with how we got here. And Judith, I know that early in your career, you helped to pass the New York bottle bill, which was one of the big legislative accomplishments early in your career. You know, I'm wondering if you were thinking about bottle bills as EPR back then, and I'm just curious about your experience as you were working on that bill.
Yes, it was a long time ago. This year is the 40th anniversary of the New York Bottle Bill, and I worked on it as a college intern with New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. And I didn't know the phrase extended producer responsibility back then, but I did know that it was a problem that beverage companies were putting so many products on the market and had no responsibility to take them back. And I thought the concept of just putting a nickel deposit and requiring them to take responsibility to recycle the containers made a lot of sense then, and it still does today.
Kirsty, what about you? What was the first time that you heard about extended producer responsibility?
Well, you know, echoing what Judith said, a long time ago when I was in college, I remember vividly my sister and I standing in Harvard Square getting signatures to, you know, expand the bottle bill in Massachusetts, you know, literally in the early 90s. So it was a nice way to meet boys, and it was a nice way to, you know, get out there and try and make a difference at the same time. It was honestly not until probably about 10 years ago that I heard the phrase extended producer responsibility. Totally agree, though some do, you know, do like to quibble on this, that deposit return systems, bottle bills, are producer responsibility. And then, of course, there are a lot of other great programs around, say, mattresses, batteries, carpets, electronics. There's lots of different ways to set up an EPR system. And I'd heard about those about 10 years ago. Some of them incentivize the return or put other, you know, carrots in place so that you make sure that you bring the product back. Others rely on other ways of doing that, other statutory ways of doing that. But it was only more recently that I heard about extended producer responsibility for packaging and paper, which has become the sexy new effort, as you all know, over the last few years to handle our plastic and our packaging crisis. Unfortunately, the devil is in the details. If those programs aren't done well, you end up with just a burning program, really a program that leads to a lot of burning of all those materials. So so definitely it took some time before I thought about packaging and EPR, but I think this is something that we're going to be working on for many years to come. And I hope that we can put some really great programs in place across the country.
Yeah, as you guys probably know, you know, I got interested in extended producer responsibility right back at the very start of my career, where 20 years ago, we were working on an extended producer responsibility bill for electronic waste in Maine. And I brought one of the founders of Upstream, Bill Sheehan, to Maine, because back then there were only a handful of experts working on EPR here in the United States. And I was so excited about the potential for having corporations actually be responsible for green design and for taking their products back. And worked with Upstream in my old organization on a number of first in the nation laws around EPR, and got to be somewhat of an expert on it. And back then, you know, we always held out packaging as kind of the holy grail. And, you know, if you look in Europe, they actually started with packaging, and they've now had these systems around for, you know, for 20 or 30 years. And Miriam and I, we were on the show a couple months ago. We were talking about how EPR has certainly increased recycling rates. Europe has some of the highest recycling rates in the world for packaging, but it really hasn't done anything to put a dent in the amount of packaging that's being generated. And so I think that, you know, I want to dive into the process that you guys and Miriam went through last summer. I understand that you pulled together a really exciting brain trust to pull together a model extended producer responsibility bill that would make EPR not just about recycling, but would also make it about how do we reduce the amount of packaging that's being generated. You know, Kirsty, maybe you could start with you and dive a little bit into that process and what you guys came up with.
Sure. I mean, I think the first step in any process, and when you're figuring out is what, you know, the question is, what is the right policy, you know, and what are the right terms to achieve your goals? So first you figure out what your goals are, and then you figure out, okay, what's going to actually work to get us there? Looking at Europe as an example, remember that Europe burns a tremendous amount of trash. Okay. Yep. And when you build an incinerator, you're stuck feeding the beast, right? Yep. So when we talk about EPR, we have to remember that we first off need to make sure we're not creating a new beast to feed. And we've seen across the board, American Chemistry Council is pushing laws to create these chemical recycling, just a different type of incinerator across the country. So first off, we needed to make sure that everybody understood, yeah, the European policies are far superior to what we have in the United States, but that doesn't mean that they're correct or perfect. And so as you said too, Matt, how do we then actually require reduction and, of course, refill and reuse whenever possible? So those are some of the big pieces. And then another thing that I'll say and then hand it over to Judith is that, you know, because Judith has this great understanding of how government works, that was really crucial. Having Judith in the room always makes things better, but she also knows a lot of stuff.
Agreed.
So, you know, having that understanding of how government works is also really crucial. But then lastly, having folks in the room, and we had some really wonderful experts who talked about toxicity, because that's another place where many of our policies in the United States and in Europe have not really gotten their arms around making sure that we're not using toxic materials in our packaging, especially mm-hmm. around foodstuffs.
Yeah. Yeah, Judith, what about you? I mean, I know that you are part of the few people that said, hey, you know, we really got to get ahead of this thing. We got to develop our own model legislation. We want to not just be responding to what industry is putting forward. How did that process come about, and what did you guys create?
Yeah, we are in a very vulnerable spot on this issue, because I think the packaging industry knows that the public wants action. And so they shrewdly have developed their own very weak extended producer responsibility proposals. They want to get it adopted. So they dodge the bullet on actually having to, for instance, reduce packaging. So my eyes were opened last year in the New York State Legislature when a very weak, problem-plagued EPR bill was introduced. And surprisingly, even some environmental groups supported it. I did the radical thing of reading the bill and and talking to experts, and wrote a couple letters to the sponsor and said, here's, you know, I appreciate your good intention, but here's where the bill falls short. Thankfully, the bill didn't pass last year. And so I convened a group of experts at Bennington College last summer and said, we need to come up with a model bill. So we had a lot of smart people in the room, And we essentially identified what are the key elements to strong EPR. And I just want to quickly go through a few.
Yeah, please.
Number one, it has to reduce packaging. A lot of these bills don't do that. So I think the disconnect with some allies is they view EPR as a way to get money to local governments to fund recycling.
Yep.
That's terrific. Yep. I support that, but that can't be the only thing. So our approach is just like you have fuel efficiency standards for cars or your dishwasher and refrigerator, we need statutory environmental standards for packaging. So what we came up with is in the next 10 years after the effective date, you must reduce, reuse, or refill your packaging by 50%. And then with what's left, it should be either easily recyclable or made from recycled content. If we do that alone, that would be a huge accomplishment. However, we've got to do more. We need to eliminate toxics from packaging. We have to not include chemical recycling, which is actually burning plastic, in the definition of recycling, which is what the American Chemistry Council is busy doing with every single EPR bill. Fourth, we want to see a separate bill that either establishes or expands bottle bills. Fifth, we want strong oversight and accountability. These bills give a lot of money and responsibility for something called a producer responsibility organization or a PRO. We need to put on our good government hat and make sure that the PRO is accountable and also provide some taxpayer relief. So yes, we want to fund local recycling programs. But if you look at plastic, for instance, which is what I spend my life working on, plastic recycling is an abysmal failure. It's achieved 8.5% recycling rate. Absolutely. So why do I want an EPR program with the singular focus of funding local plastic recycling? That doesn't solve the problem.
Well, I take that a step further too, Judith, just to interject, and that is plastic recycling is actually, as the system is set up now and as the way we're using plastic now, an impossibility. It's not just that we're not collecting it and sorting it well in all those pieces. It's that there are so many different types of plastic and so many different ways of mixing components. In other words, paper cups lined with plastic. That's what you, when you buy a coffee, cup of coffee in a paper cup, that's what you're getting. So all of those things make it actually impossible. But further than that, plastic is so toxic and so terrible for the environment. And also, even best case scenario, can only be recycled a few times. You know, like say the numbers vary, but even the most recyclable plastic can only be recycled, what, half a dozen times, would you say? Maybe 10. So it's not like glass, which is infinitely recyclable. So recycling is not going to get us out of the hole we've dug for ourselves. And then the other thing too, when you're talking about Pat, and this is something that came out in our conversations last summer as we were creating this great policy that you just outlined, one of the things you have to remember is that package that you have in your hand when you buy something is only part of the problem. There's transportation packaging in the background that are as much as 50 or 60% of the materials being used and wasted many times. So when we ask for reduction and reusables, it could be as much as, you know, reusing pallets. It could be big containers that all, you know, all your toothpaste may be in a tube. Those tubes might be in a big container that is then reused, and that might get you there a lot of times. So when you understand that deep, those two problems, one of plastic not truly being recyclable, it really isn't, and two, the transportation packaging piece, you realize how sensible the bill that we put together is.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Kirsty. I mean, I think that when we look at what EPR has intended to do, right? I mean, I go back to the original packaging EPR directive in Europe passed in the early 90s, it has source reduction and reuse built into the first lines of the governing document. If you go to the EPR bills that have been passed here in North America. You go up to British Columbia, for example, that has been kind of the leader on EPR for packaging. It has been about, you know, in theory, there's been this conversation that this really needs to be about reduce and reuse. But in practice, you know, I just had a conversation with my colleague, Sue, who has been working on the British Columbia legislation and has done a lot of work for city and provincial government up there around EPR. You know, they have increased recycling rates, but their waste generation rates per capita have gone up by 30% over the last 10 years. Yes. And so, you know, we're not actually reducing the stress on the natural world, right? And when I think about why do we care? Like, why do we want a circular economy for packaging? For me, it always goes up to we want to reduce the extraction of natural resources, you know, trees and the destruction of landscapes for mining and all of these things on the front end of our consumer product economy. And on the back end, we want to reduce the pollution and we want to reduce the waste and we want to create better economic models that provide for good local and regional economies and good local and regional jobs. And this is why I always come back to reuse. You know, when I think about what the brands have done around quote unquote source reduction, you know, there's been this huge lightweighting push over the last 10 years to make packaging as lightweight, you know, they call it packaging optimization, as lightweight as possible. That's been done. The engineers have gone to work on that. They've made the packaging as light as possible. It's been done. And so, you know, on the recycling side, yeah, sure. Like you were saying, Judith, we can get some more money for local governments to help them with recycling, but that's not the game changer. The game changer is really reorganizing how we consume. And I get really excited about these reuse models because we start to break down these consumable products into these, you know, regional loops where we're putting products out in reusable packaging, we're collecting them, we're washing them, we're refilling and restocking them, and we're doing that in these local and regional loops. And I think when policymakers can really understand that this isn't just about the environment, like this is about the economy, this is about jobs, this is about resiliency, economic resiliency, I think people can get more excited about it. So I wonder if we could dive into that a little bit more. So, you know, Judith, I appreciated what you talked about developing a bill that has these targets of rates and dates, something that we've advocated for here at Upstream. I mean, what has the response been from not just legislators, but stakeholders around these ideas?
It has not been good, which is a little surprising. The way I'm approaching EPR is fundamentally different than the way the traditional approach to EPR has been. And legislators, some, are having a hard time getting their head around requiring reduction, whether it's reduction, refill, reuse. I think they're going to get there, but it's a real paradigm shift for them. And there's also a cottage industry of recycling consultants, and they're not thinking reduction. They're thinking recycling. So if you talk to the public, if you can even get, you don't call it EPR because it's a terrible name, but the public wants plastics reduction. The public wants packaging reduction. And when you talk to ordinary people, they get it. But when you talk to legislators and even environmental advocates, they don't get it. You know, I've had a couple salty conversations with allies and friends who keep telling me when it comes to the eco-modulated fees that go with EPR, they constantly say, that's the industry's money. So you can't tell them how to spend it. And I say, sure, I can. And it's not the industry's money. It's consumers are paying these eco-modulated fees. So we're in a really perilous time. I think we are pushing the envelope because of everything you just articulated. You know, the United States has 4% of the world's population, but we gobble up 24% of the world's natural resources. That has to change. And then you look at the waste end, and incinerators and landfills are almost always sited in low-income and/or communities of color.
Yep.
That has to change. So when you look at the scale of what we're trying to tackle, of course you should have mandatory reduction requirements, but most EPR bills do not. Most EPR bills do not require toxics reduction. Most EPR bills allow chemical recycling, which is burning of plastic, to be included in the definition of EPR. Mm-hmm. So there's this real disconnect between, I wouldn't even say what's politically possible versus what the actual policy needs are. There's a disconnect between what we need to get accomplished and what even some groups are willing to ask for.
Yeah.
And I'm not being aspirational. I'm being really practical. I am tired of New York City's solid waste being exported to an environmental justice community in Newark, New Jersey. We have to do everything we can to reduce that.
Judith, that was an excellent point about New York's trash going to Newark, New Jersey. And we're seeing the same thing in New England, where Massachusetts, which is the big trash producer in New England, is sending a lot of its trash not only to Ohio and to the Carolinas, but also to Maine and New Hampshire, wherever it's a little cheap, land is a little cheaper.
Yeah, it does seem like solid waste disposal is completely unregulated in terms of where it goes. I mean, when it gets to the landfill or incinerator, there are some regulations, but it's a bit of the Wild West. And you've got large private companies making large amounts of money. So they don't have any incentive to reduce waste, but particularly because waste is being sent by diesel truck or train long distances, almost always winding in low-income communities and or communities of color, that should be an enormous incentive to require packaging reduction in every EPR law. And the governor's proposal in New York didn't require reduction and then set up an industry-dominated advisory committee that was supposed to make recommendations on whether or not to even require recycled content.
Yeah.
They weren't even directed to address reduction. So we have to really up our game in terms of what these EPR bills look like. And if the bills are not good, we need to be politically brave and say no. We'd rather have no EPR than weak EPR, and let's just keep at it. We know it's going to take years, but we can't settle for systems that don't work.
You know, I think a big part of the problem is what you were saying at the beginning, Judith, which is, you know, we're stuck in this recycling first mentality, even though we've got, you know, reduce and reuse ahead of recycling in the waste reduction hierarchy. Where most people are operating with the world as it is, as opposed to how it could be. And mm-hmm. So you've got, like you said, you've got all these recycling consultants that make a lot of money. They can only see the world today, unfortunately, through the lens of recycling. And I do think that is shifting and that's changing. I think because of the enthusiasm that a lot of brands have around the possibilities of reuse, that is starting to shift. I think some of the people that have been recycling consultants are noticing that there are opportunities to maybe get involved in working on reuse. But I do think that's a big part of the problem, is that folks first need to have this gestalt that recycling is nowhere near enough. And then this other gestalt that, you know, we can't just shift out a single-use plastic to some other single-use material. That's also not going to get us there. That's only trading one set of environmental issues for others. And so, you know, coming back to what do we need to do to get there? You know, Kirsty, I'm curious about what I know that you guys have been involved. I know this model bill that was developed in Bennington was introduced into Rhode Island, where you guys are working. You know, what have you been doing to engage and educate legislators and other stakeholders around getting source reduction and reuse established in statute? And, you know, what do you think has been working as far as engaging folks, and what hasn't worked so well?
Well, one thing that I think is very effective and will have a ripple effect in a lot of different ways is to dispel this notion that breaking down the constituents of plastic and then burning them separately is somehow recycling. Like, you know, that chemical recycling or advanced recycling, as they call it, is not recycling. So that's one thing. And I think a lot of people, you know, when you talk about the gestalt around recycling, I think a lot of people don't understand that, for instance, in New England, most of the glass and curbside never gets recycled. It gets used as landfill cover or roadbed. So, you know, we defined recycling very loosely in many regulations and allows for downcycling or just, you know, pretending to recycle. So not only is recycling not enough, but recycling has to be actual recycling. And then, so, and not burning, right? Anything with a smokestack, it is not going to work for, if we want to actually solve our climate problem. Right? I think that's really important for people to understand. I also think that, you know, something that you touched on, Matt, about, you know, looking at the upstream impacts, this, you know, the waste problem has the potential, and EPR has the potential to be an incredible climate mover. And what I mean by that is we could avoid the fracking and cracking and, you know, all the different pieces of making plastic, right? Like, that's huge for the climate. You can avoid the bauxite mining. You can avoid the cutting down of trees, all of those pieces, right? But not only that, what people don't understand is that if you take a glass bottle and recycle it, it's much less energy is used than if you started with raw materials and created a virgin glass bottle.
Yep.
And then likewise, if you refill a glass bottle 40, 50 times, even 10 times, you've saved a tremendous amount of energy because there's much less energy expended to just wash it than it is to recycle the bottle. And that's true for almost everything, right? So when I hear folks talking about light loading, for instance, and how that's so fantastic, two things occur to me. One, the moving of goods is going to always continue. That's not actually our problem for the climate. It's a problem, but it's not a permanent problem. It's a problem that once we shift over to electric vehicles, we can solve.
Right, right.
And also that's much less impact on the climate. Moving of goods is much less of an impact on the climate than creating goods. The heat needed to melt a bottle, melt down that glass, cull it, and make a new bottle out of it is so much more than just washing the bottle. So I think people continue to not understand that your real bang for your buck on climate is going to be refill and reuse whenever possible. So that's huge. And then lastly, and this is something we haven't touched on today, and it's not a particular area of expertise to me, but I think everyone should be aware of it. We need to avoid plastic because it's getting into our bodies. It's in our lungs, it's in our bloodstream. And so as a result, those microplastics are everywhere in our environment and our bodies. They're going to have a tremendously negative impact on our ecosystems as well as our health. So, that's another reason why single-use reduction is so important, because those disposables almost always include a plastic component and they're poisoning us.
You know, I'm really glad you brought the climate lens and the toxics and environmental health lens into the conversation. You know, I think that again, going back to the way that EPR and even, you know, bottle deposits and these other tools that we have, they're typically thought of as waste tools, right? Like, and so they're thinking, people are looking at them as kind of these are downstream tools, as opposed to thinking about them as tools to actually prevent climate pollution and prevent natural resource destruction. And all of that is, that's upstream. That's all on the front end. And so, you know, that gestalt is so important. And, you know, it sounds like from what I'm hearing from you guys in working on the ground in state legislatures, you're still running up against that perception that, this is just about, you know, more money for recycling. And this is just about better recycling, as opposed to, no, these are, you know, this is how we can actually address the climate impacts of consumption, which, you know, Upstream has been hip on this, as you guys probably remember. Like, we put out this report, you know, way back in 2009.
It's in your name, you're Upstream.
That's right. You know, but, you know, I just wondered, you know, coming back to you, Judith, like, what do you think it's going to take to help get folks to think about things in terms of like the totality? Because it's easier to kind of just compartmentalize and say, oh, okay, this is about litter, or this is about, you know, more money for local governments for recycling, as opposed to, you know, this is really about how do we build a just and equitable circular economy. You know, I think that that piece becomes a lot harder, and it's harder for busy legislators and the other stakeholders to do. So what do we need to do to really get people to think bigger and understand the implications of some of these policies?
Well, it starts, Matt, with the way we frame it. So I had a very hectic few weeks in the New York State Legislature trying to beat back a bad EPR bill. I really never had the luxury of talking about the climate change connection, which is too bad. I mean, Beyond Plastics put out this great report last fall, The New Coal, Plastics and Climate Change.
By the way. Everybody needs to read this report.
It's very good. It was a hard report written by Jim Vallette in Maine. And what, you know, even when I was talking to legislators who are tuned into climate change, climate change didn't come up in the EPR fight. And that was probably, you know, I take some responsibility for that because it was just, it was budget season. There was little time with people. So I think starting with the way we frame the issue, I like to quote Bill McKibben, a Beyond Plastics Advisory Board member, as is Matt. McKibben has an article out recently in The New Yorker where he argues, stop burning everything. So whether it's burning fossil fuels or wood from forests or solid waste. And, you know, we have to just broaden the conversation. This is, I support recycling. I started my town's recycling program decades ago. And recycling for metal and glass and cardboard and paper works. Plastic recycling has been a failure. So we have to shift the conversation away from money for local recycling to the broader lens. And you know who gets this? Grassroots advocates.
Yep.
People are thirsty for these solutions. They're turning out to events. They're contacting legislators. So you need to stay engaged with the grassroots while you educate lawmakers and governors.
Kirsty, what about you? What do you think we need to do to kind of help elevate these debates and frame them in ways that connect with more people and connect to bigger issues than just, you know, who pays for recycling and, you know, those types of kind of downstream, you know, smaller impact types of things?
Well, definitely it's about framing. Judith's absolutely correct. And I think that you do have to be sensitive. You can't have a tin ear. You have to know who you're talking to and what is driving them and what they're concerned about, of course. And that's going to be different for every legislator in every state. I would say that one of the most important things that I've, roles that, for instance, CLF has played is to call out who is making what argument and why they're making it. Like, as we've already touched upon, waste companies, incinerators, and landfills, they have a small percentage of their income is recycling, but they really make their money burying and burning waste, and it's per ton. So they don't want a reduction per ton. And once you explain that to a legislator and explain the idea of a tipping fee, they say, oh, wait a second. Okay. So they tell me they want recycling because they get paid by the ton for that too, wherever it ends up, even if it doesn't get recycled. So they're cool with us doing this forever, even if none of it's getting recycled and we're never going to reduce anything. And so that's important that, you know, legislators understand that. And then also legislators need to be disabused of the notion that that Judith mentioned earlier, that we're using these corporations' money to solve our problem. The corporations have caused this problem, and we don't really have options. I can't buy many food products unless they're wrapped in plastic. Like, there's literally not an option if I want to eat and feed my family. So as a result of that, I don't have choices, and I have to pay as the taxpayer for the pollution and have my health degraded and have to pay, you know, for the recycling and waste system that's not working on top of that. Yeah, so this isn't me making a choice and imposing my will on a corporation. This is a corporation having to clean up the mess they make. And so that's really important to, you know, that's really important to make sure they understand that and that you can show, you know, the cottage industry that Judith referred to of recycling experts and consultants. they're folks who are being paid by these corporations to keep the corporation's costs down. Keep that in mind. That's who they are. That's their job. That doesn't make them bad people, but it does make what they're saying many times an obfuscation, if not an outright lie. So you have to really be honest about that. Yeah.
And I would just add on EPR, you have to pay attention to these producer responsibility organizations that are being proposed. Who's controlling them? You have to follow the money. And right now, the way most EPR proposals are drafted, the producer responsibility organizations are controlled by the packaging industry. We would not expect the tobacco industry to come up with a plan on reducing smoking. Why do we expect the packaging industry to come up with a plan to deal with packaging, especially when there's no statutory requirement that they have to deal with reduction? So, you know, following the money, understanding the structure of the PROs are really important. But I have a bit of a biased view as a former federal regulator. I think the way you drive change is by adopting new laws that are needed and making sure the laws are understood by the public and enforced.
Yep.
So we need two things to happen to really reduce plastic pollution and packaging. One is we need strong extended producer responsibility laws on the books, but the reality is we are being politically outgunned by the packaging industry. And the second thing we need is to make sure that chemical recycling, aka plastic burning, doesn't proceed. And there are two avenues that we need to pay attention to. One is the chemical lobbyists are trying to insert definitions of recycling in EPR bills that would allow for chemical recycling or let the state agency decide whether to allow it or not. Bad idea. The second thing is we're seeing standalone bills that would exempt chemical recycling from recycling and solid waste laws and also provide enormous public subsidies. There are now 16 states that have done that with chemical recycling. So we've got to be on patrol for both the standalone bad bills and also inserting bad definitions of recycling in EPR. In my view, the place that we really need to focus on in the next few years is the need for strong EPR and blocking incentives for chemical recycling. If we are not super active on both of those fronts, we are going to continue to see the proliferation of plastics and other packaging and all of the environmental justice and natural resource depletion damage that goes with that.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, Judith. And as an organizer, my mind immediately goes to the organizing strategy and, you know, the need to get alignment amongst our friends and allies around the country around these ideas that you just said, as well as building a bigger and broader coalition. And so, you know, there is a lot of work that has to be done first on, you know, as you were saying, we also have to educate our friends and allies. And sometimes mm-hmm. that's not just other nonprofit organizations. Sometimes that's our allies in government. It's our allies in business. And we need to get alignment around these things and then build a more powerful, more integrated movement across the country to do these things that you just mentioned. And I would add to that list, I think that one of the things that is hamstringing us on setting up new reuse systems is that we need more of them adopted at scale and we need more experimentation. Right. You know, we're going to need a lot more investment in building out that infrastructure so that we can point to the future and say, hey, it doesn't just have to be like this. We don't have to take a glass bottle and smash it and ship it somewhere so it's got to, you know, go through this recycling process. We can just refill it. They're doing it in Ontario. They're doing it in Quebec. They're doing it in Oregon. You know, why aren't we doing it in New England?
We did it here. We did it here, Matt. We did it when we were kids. That's what how Coke and Pepsi operated, you know?
That's right. That's right. Well, and I think too, like just, you know, we've got these models now with all these local dairies that are bringing back the milkman model and the refillable glass bottle. And so, you know, we know that we can do it. And I think that there's, you know, a lot of work that has to be done on the aligning and organizing, like you were saying, Judith, but I'm really excited about it. So I know we're close to the end here. I wanted to just dive into one other thing before I let you guys go here. And that is, you know, the connection between deposit refund or deposit return systems, bottle bills, and EPR. And, you know, we have put out the position, and it's going to be tied to this podcast when we put this all out next week, that deposit return systems really in ideally should either come first or they should come at the same time as EPR systems are getting established. We don't want EPR without deposit return for beverage and potentially for other higher value materials. And I think that the big reason why this is so important is that they build out different types of infrastructure. And, you know, more recycling is not going to help prevent litter like deposit return systems do. It's not going to help preserve the value of high value materials like aluminum, for example, which we get source separated through these deposit return systems. There's so many other things that are important for why we need deposit return. And so, you know, last year we had EPR systems added to deposit return systems in Oregon and Maine, which I had no problem with. But this year we're starting to see EPR bills get introduced into states that don't have deposit return systems. And I'm just curious about your guys' perspective, having worked on these issues so intimately. You know, how do we ensure that we don't lose, deposit return and bottle bills in the EPR discussion in states that don't yet have bottle bills? And Kirsty, I'm going to start with you.
Matt, I could not agree with you more. You need to have your deposit return system or your bottle bill in place first because of all the reasons you mentioned, but also because bottle bills work for the three types of containers that they target, which is glass, aluminum, and then plastic, meaning number one or number two plastic beverage containers. And when I say they work, I don't just mean that we're going to recycle some of them. We recycle almost all of them if your deposit is correct. That's one of the things that's crucial. But, you know, deposit return systems, which are necessary if we want a refill system for beverages, right? Which is that's the gold standard. That's what we're shooting for, as we were just talking about. You need to have a certain return rate to make that a possibility. And you get that return rate if you have the right deposit fee and the right handling fee. You get that return rate with a deposit return system or bottle bill. You don't get that kind of return. You don't get to the 90%, you know, return rate. And remember, everything that's returned almost in a bottle bill is recycled. So we're talking 90%, you know, return and almost 90% recycling. In contrast, if you're talking about curbside materials, if you put bottle bill materials, the beverage containers in curbside, as I said earlier, the glass is just not going to get recycled. Glass should not be in curbside. And in places like Europe and many parts of Canada, it's not allowed in curbside. So you don't want your glass in there at all. It contaminates all the paper and the cardboard. It contaminates the plastic. It's a mess. You're not going to get to that same return or recycling rate ever with your curbside materials, even if it's beverage containers in the curbside. So an EPR system layered onto a curbside system might get you 30, 40% return of your beverage containers. That's not great. And it's not going to be the same kind of best use recycling that we want to see. It's not going to be bottle-to-bottle recycling. And then the final point on this, and this is something that people need to understand about curbside recycling whenever you do it, curbside plastic recycling will not yield food-grade plastic ever. Because any plastic you have in curbside, even if it's a water bottle, might be contaminated by, say, a bottle of bleach or a bottle of Roundup. So as a result, it just is never going to happen. You cannot recycle bottles, plastic bottles and curbside into plastic bottles ever. So as a result, it's just, it's not even allowed by contract, because, you know, in the contracts that these beverage companies have. So again, if you want to see any plastic beverage recycling, which is not the end goal, but it's an interim goal. If you want to see any beverage plastic bottles made into bottles, that means a bottle bill that cannot be done through curbside.
Although I want to add, I mean, I agree with everything Kirsty has just said, but we need to be politically aware that in many states, beverage companies want to include beverage containers in an EPR program and not have a bottle bill.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's exactly right, Judith. And that's a huge problem. We need to have, you know, the fact that we don't have deposit return systems or bottle bills across this country in every state is bananas. It's a lost opportunity. It's a lost opportunity to have good local jobs. It's a lost opportunity to conserve resources. It's a lost opportunity to work on climate, save us all a lot of money in our recycling costs and litter cleanup, as Matt said. I mean, I can't say enough about bottle bills, and they should be the first step, as Matt said.
Well, guys, this has been so much fun. I love hanging out and nerding out with you on this stuff. And, you know, we should do this more often. It's just been a super pleasure to have you both on the show. I look forward to the next time we get to talk about this stuff. And good luck in the rest of the legislative sessions. We so appreciate the work that you guys are doing on the ground, your organizations are doing to move good EPR forward, to move deposit return systems forward, and to grow this circular economy, just an equitable circular economy that we need here in the United States. So thanks so much to both of you, and look forward to our next conversation.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable Podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.